This is the Takeaway Weekender. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. So what do you think you would remember from a duck hunting trip with the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court? Say you did this when you were just starting out in your life. Or how do you think you would feel to be compared to Donald Trump, especially this week? Well, those issues came up in a conversation with the governor of the most populous state in the U.S. and the former ambassador from the U.S. to the most populous nation on earth. Both men tried for the White House. John Huntsman served one term in the Utah State House before jetting off to Beijing as U.S. ambassador to China. He ran for the GOP nomination in 2012. These days, Huntsman has a lot of concerns about his party's message in the 2016 presidential race, especially when it comes to Donald Trump. And if you listen closely to this conversation a little later on in the program, you might hear a comparison between the GOP and the Whig Party of the 1800s. Meanwhile, Governor Jerry Brown of California gave us a personal view of his challenges in dealing with Western wildfires and global warming, which he says are related. Brown, you may recall, has served in the California State House longer than any other governor. And he once had ambitions for a higher office. He ran for president in 1976, 1980, and 1992, when he had this memorable exchange with a fellow governor, another candidate, a young man named Bill Clinton.
He is funneling money to his wife's law firm for state business. That's number one.
I don't care what you say about me, but you ought to be ashamed of yourself for jumping on my wife. You're not worth being on the same platform as my
wife. I'll tell you something, Mr. Clinton.
Now,
don't try to escape it. Ralph Nader called me this afternoon. He read me the article from the Washington Post.
Does that make it
true? I was shocked by it.
In Brown's 1980 presidential run, his then-girlfriend Linda Ronstadt raked in the campaign cash at a Las Vegas benefit concert.
He went out to run for president for the last couple of months, and hadn't been for the fact that I got to see him on TV every night. I forgot what he looked like. But he came back yesterday. He's going to make it all better now. So he told me anyway.
Nice memories there and a nice party, but it didn't get Jerry Brown the nomination. His political successes have stayed in California. Once upon a time, Jerry Brown talked about environmentalism as a futuristic movement. In his current term, it's all about the present, though. A historic drought has left his state high, dry, and susceptible to wildfires, which are now burning across the state.
The historic droughts that California has seen over the centuries were periods where rain and snow was diminished. But now we have an additional factor, and that's rising temperature. And the vegetation, they're very, very dry. They're like tinder. They just explode upon contact. So in our most recent fire, without winds, the fire spread in every direction. That's completely unprecedented. And we think that is a climate change consequence. So we're short of water. People have to conserve. Farmers have to find greater efficiencies or let their land lie fallow. And we're increasing our spending on personnel and equipment to fight fires that have at least another 2 months to go.
All right. So do you think this fire situation is different from previous fire emergencies you've dealt with or that have been dealt with in your state?
This fire is different. Usually in late August, September, the Santa Ana winds start blowing, and that definitely pushes more fire and spreads it more quickly. This fire, the Rocky Fire in Lake County, California, spread in all directions with very modest winds.
All right, then if this is different and it's spreading with modest winds, why not a more aggressive use of personnel, the National Guard, the military, to deal with these fires earlier on in the crisis?
Well, we're spending $100 million more this year and $100 million more last year. So we're putting in money. We're getting personnel from many other surrounding states. We've bought more tankers to drop chemical on these fires. We're doing a lot. Now, going forward, we probably want to do more preventative fires, more rangeland management. So there's lots of things to do. But I would say we're at full throttle when it comes to fighting fires in 2015.
An inconvenient truth came out many, many years ago. It seems to me that much more preemptive work could have been done to both pre-position water programs and water strategies for this drought and pre-position assets to deal with the fires, but neither was done.
Well, that might be true if you're in a tiny little state like Vermont or Rhode Island. This is a California. We stretch from the Oregon border to the Mexican border. If you want to pre-position, where do you pre-position? In the northern state, part of the state, or 500 or 600 miles to the south? So we don't know where or when the fires break out. We have to be ready. So I would say the fire officials have done a credible job. But the fact is, temperatures are rising, and as they rise, and then when drought occurs, we get these conflagrations and the problems that you've probably seen on television.
Let's talk about your water tunnel project for a moment, if we could. Can you rule out at this moment the acquisition through eminent domain of farmlands in the Delta before the tunnel project is actually approved?
I don't know that anyone ever raised the question of ruling that out. We've been working on this project for years. In fact, the general concept of bypassing the Delta has been thought about since my father was governor in the late 50s. So the fresh water that comes from the rivers of the north and flows through the Delta and then gets into the aqueduct to go to Silicon Valley, if we don't have this tunnel, then we're subject to the vagaries of the weather. And the fresh water is protected for a number of miles by only dirt levees. Those dirt levees are 100 years old. They will fail. Now, they're going to fail because the sea level rises. They're going to fail because extreme weather events or because of an earthquake. So we have to do something. In order to do something, you do whatever you have to do on a large construction project. We're going to do the best we can. I have no doubt this is in the best interest of the state. And while there's a very vociferous opposition in the local area, looked at from the point of view of the state, looked at from the point of view of tens of thousands of pages of careful environmental and technical analysis, and looked at from the point of view that engineers have been thinking about this for decades, I would say delay is not our friend, but proceeding apace is the wiser course.
I'm not criticizing the project itself. I'm just asking, will you use eminent domain to acquire farmlands in the Delta to construct the project?
Whenever you build a bridge or a road, eminent domain is an available tool. Many times the landowners will sell or lease whatever space is required for the project. So eminent domain is a reality in contemporary society for the public good. If you don't have eminent domain, people don't sell. So if you're asking me, forswear it, I would say that isn't the way projects are built.
On the question of immigration, some have described California as the best place to be an immigrant in the United States, undocumented or not. Is that a success of your policies or a sign that policies and an approach to immigration is actually out of control?
If you see immigrants who are farm workers living in cardboard boxes or out of their cars in various parts of Southern California, you wouldn't want to use the word best for that situation. There are a lot of hardships on the part of hundreds of thousands of people who've made the trek across the border. Across this country, there's been such a shortage in workers, particularly in construction projects, that many projects have had to shut down or delay. So there is a desperate need for workers, and workers have responded. Now, how are things in California? I'd say we're being humane. We're not going around arresting mothers when they go to the grocery store for their families that have been living here 10 years. We're trying to balance things off. And if somebody is working, as a million immigrants are in California, without a driver's license, we've now provided a path forward. And I think almost 300,000 licenses have been issued to undocumented people. So we're trying to make the best of this situation. But if you look at immigration across the border in America, and then you look over to Europe and the people by the thousands who are dying crossing the Mediterranean and the riots in Germany and Poland and problems in Italy, this is a global problem. It'll probably get worse. And I would say, by and large, California has a balanced, thoughtful program that is dealing with this in the utter abdication on the part of Congress, particularly the Republican majority, that has adopted a see no evil, hear no evil, do nothing. And so we can't wait around. We got human beings. They have families. We got to do something. It is not trouble-free, but as you look over the scene across the world, I'd say California is a shining example.
Is there a security problem for immigrations and citizens in the state of California? And does the Catherine Steinle case give Donald Trump an argument for sending them all back, all 11 million undocumented workers in the United States?
Oh, well, I don't think Donald Trump needs to be given an argument. He's quite articulate on his own. Actually, I would say if you give him a thread, he can weave a rug. So, no, he has plenty to argue about. And the fact is, in California, as well across America, you have homicides, and the vast majority are by good old-fashioned American citizens. But there are some that are undocumented. And I would say it's always a tragedy when someone is killed, and we're doing everything we can to keep the lowest murder rate the nation has ever seen, probably in the last 30 years. So lots to be done, but perfection is only for the next life.
You went from the seminary to UC Berkeley. What was it like to spend time with the Pope, someone who had also a very interesting trajectory in his education?
I thought you were going to ask me what it's like to go from the seminary to Berkeley, and that's a whole interesting story, but I will take the
second. Seems like you and the Pope have something in common, though, about
because the Pope didn't go to Berkeley in 1960.
That's true.
Which was the beginning of lots of turmoil. Anyway, it was great being in the Vatican, listening to the Pope, meeting the mayors from around the world, dealing with climate change in a very forthright and serious way. I found the Pope articulate, very authentic and human, persuasive, speaking without notes. He's a real leader. And on this topic, both of climate change and the vulnerable people that are facing the ravages of forced immigration and trafficking and all these other things we read about, he is really an inspiration.
But he did go from seminary to the political hotbed of Argentina, just as you went from the seminary to
went in a cassock. I did.
That's true.
I went to Berkeley and lived at the International House and encountered girls and all the other vices that were on offer in the 1960s.
You're very forthright.
I said I encountered them. I didn't necessarily say advantage of them.
That's right. What do you think would be most fun, going duck hunting with the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court or going to a soccer game with the Pope? You've done one. How about the other?
Well, instead of going to a soccer game, I'd rather have a theological and philosophical discussion with the Pope and talk to him about the Jesuit order and about the secular world we're living in, and how we might deal with some of these very intractable problems like climate change, mass migration all over the planet, and the persistent threat of nuclear annihilation as represented by the doomsday clock that is now 3 minutes to midnight, which the atomic scientists keep track of.
Finally, then, is that what you talked about with Earl Warren when you went duck hunting with him as a young man about civil rights and the problems of America?
You know, the truth, I went duck hunting with Earl Warren probably around 1962, maybe 63. The only thing I can remember, besides seeing the ducks flying overhead and then seeing the dogs go out and grab them and how pretty they look flying and seeing them dead there, all bundled up and actually holding on to some, was the crab soup that we had. It had a kind of a Roquefort taste to it, and it was extremely tasty, and I've never had it since. Plus, being around Earl Warren is a pleasure. He's a man of incredible dignity, and I don't think I've ever seen a politician quite like him, ever.
Governor Jerry Brown, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
And now former Utah Governor John Huntsman. He's a more subdued politician than Jerry Brown, and as you might imagine, the whole Donald Trump thing and the other candidates' reactions to Donald Trump have both entertained and appalled John Huntsman. Here's Trump sounding not exactly like James Mattis.
The first thing is building a wall, which Mexico will pay for. There's a very big question as to the anchor babies. We have thousands and thousands of illegal immigrants in our country, not only taking jobs, but many of them are causing problems beyond belief.
Donald Trump on immigration. Is he a revolutionary for the GOP on this issue? Actually, not really. Remember, Mitt Romney in 2012 was suggesting that illegal immigrants should self-deport.
Well, the answer is self-deportation, which is people decide that they can do better by going home because they can't find work here because they don't have legal documentation to allow them to work here.
Well, this habit of referencing the immigration debate with words like walls and claims of hordes of illegals taking jobs runs exactly counter to what the GOP was supposed to have learned in its 2012 loss. A 97-page research document to advise the party for 2016 says that Republicans are marginalizing themselves. In the absence of major change, it will be increasingly difficult for Republicans to win a presidential election in the near future without embracing and championing comprehensive immigration reform. John M. Huntsman Jr. is now the chairman of the Atlantic Council, and he's happy not to be a candidate like he was in 2012. He hinted to me that he's been watching the current proceedings with the horror of watching someone jump off a building in super slow-mo.
I mean, how many unnatural acts can be committed simultaneously? It's entertaining, on one level, because we're seeing so much that is unprecedented that we've never seen in politics before. It's frustrating in that the stakes are so high. And there's a lot on the line in terms of future U.S. policy, not only domestically but foreign. That is riding this election cycle. So I watch it with a sense of amusement, but also with a deep sense of frustration.
Do you think we're learning more about these candidates in the debates and the candidate events and in the headlines from day to day, or are we learning more about where the electorate is right now?
Well, I think we're learning about where a small fraction of the electorate is, and that's the sorry commentary on the primary season. We're hearing from a small fraction of voters in Iowa, and we'll soon hear from a larger percentage of voters in New Hampshire because that's a primary as opposed to a caucus, and then we'll be back to certain closed caucuses, for example, in Nevada. So it's a little despairing that, you know, in an election cycle as important as this one, and of course they're all important, we don't have more people turning out participating and registering their voices. They wait until the very end, if at all. So right now, I think we're getting a snapshot of a very small percentage of the population and probably not a very good read of where the candidates really are because they're tailoring their messages and they're packaging themselves to pander to that small percentage who were turning out in these early days.
All right, go with me here on this one. Now, when you ran, when you entered the primary race, in a sense, you had certain things in common with Donald Trump in the sense that you offered yourself as an outlier, as someone who comes from the Obama administration, right? I mean, you were different in that regard. You were potentially self-financing, right? You were very well off. I mean, I don't know, you know, what your tax forms are compared to Donald Trump. Hair is very different.
Not even in the league.
Of course, yeah. Okay, very, very much. So, and I do remember that part of your message was that because you were not a traditional politician, because you were more of a, you know, issues-oriented governor, that you would connect with voters better. Now we see Donald Trump with some of these same attributes, but he's connecting, and for some reason you weren't able to connect. What's he doing right? What would you do to achieve what he's done?
Well, it's a totally different set of circumstances. And so I brought with me a record of service. I'd actually served a Democrat as a Republican, which was not well thought of in the primary phase of the campaign. I got in late. I had a record as governor, some very non-traditional issues for a Republican in terms of gay rights, in terms of the environment, health care reform, education reform. We did a lot of things that weren't out of a single orthodoxy playbook. And that's the one thing that Trump does not have. So he's a totally clean slate, and people can put on that slate anything that grieves them. They don't like the state of immigration. They don't like the state of Washington. Well, he's a guy who can cure all. And lucky for him, he has no history, no record, no voting record, no policy record where people can then pull apart his comments. So he gets away saying whatever he wants. He can invent himself and reinvent himself as he goes. Those of us who came from public service, who served both internationally and domestically, just didn't have that luxury.
Let's talk about tone. When Teddy Roosevelt was vice president before McKinley was assassinated, the Republican Party was terrified of him because of his tone, his brusque, say anything, unpredictability. He became president, and historians have said that but for the fact that he became president, he might never have been elected on the first go-around. But his record as president made him popular enough to be elected again. Do you think tone matters? Do you think Trump is doing a Teddy Roosevelt here, or is he doing a, I don't know, a reality show thing?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think he's a genius when it comes to knowing what sells. He understands his audience. He understands that in politics, as in business, you need leverage. When you have leverage in the game, then you can go as far as you want. And so his leverage is his locked-in constituency. That's, you know, 20-25% of the early Republican caucus goers. He knows how to get them. He knows how to hold them. He knows the message that will compel them. And a lot of that is anger. Let's face it. You know, you play to anger. You play to divisiveness. I remember well from the last election cycle, the last couple election cycles, people wanted anger, not just passion, but they want to see anger. They want to see somebody who's resolved, who's going to rip the system down, rage against the machine and rebuild it. And so he's savvy enough as a marketeer to know what people are looking for out there and how he needs to calibrate his message. I think in a sense that he's innately that way, but I think the parallels with Teddy Roosevelt, you know, who took over from William McKinley after his assassination, was reelected and then stormed out of the convention of 1912. You know, he was a war hero. He was a chief of police. He was assistant secretary of the Navy. He'd been a governor of a major state. He'd, you know, fought foreign enemies. He brought a certain swagger based on his personal credentials and experiences that sort of gave him that worldview and his ability to frame it in a very unique fashion. I think so. That wasn't marketing. That was just real world commentary. I don't think we're hearing real world commentary right now. I think it's more marketing.
Teddy Roosevelt's celebrity came from a real record of public service, not so much with Donald Trump. Why aren't the other GOP candidates able to combat this, apparently? Why are the numbers still favoring Trump, and why hasn't anyone emerged really as a one-on-one with Donald Trump?
I think they're so stunned. They've been dealt such a body blow. Every one of them would have thought that the Trump phenomenon would have been in today and out tomorrow, and it would have had very minimal lasting effect on the early primary voters. I think they're also stunned by where we are and continue to find ourselves, so they don't have an adequate response. So in some cases, you're seeing some candidates who are basically just glomming on to what Trump is saying, repeal of certain amendments in the Constitution to take away birthright. I heard one candidate in the last day or two basically say, in a not well prepared paragraph, I agree with that too, and that's kind of where I am. So in a unique way, you know, Trump has got everyone so stunned, so befuddled that they don't know what to do, and in a sense, they're kind of caving in on some of these nativist issues where they fear that they're going to lose some of those early primary voters if they don't have a response.
Republican Party did a postmortem of the general both in 2008 and in 2012 and determined and spent good money on this and determined that, you know, talking about walls and illegals and undocumented and, you know, using these send them all back kinds of rhetorical devices is exactly the wrong thing to be doing if you want to win the White House in 2016. Not that we would expect Donald Trump to listen to anything that the Republican Party would commission as a report, but to hear all the other candidates using the same language, is this a gigantic self-immolation as regards the Hispanic vote in the United States?
We're 15 years behind the times. We're 15 years behind the times, at least. And when you stop to think that politics is a pretty simple mathematical equation, I mean, you have to have 270 electoral college votes to win the presidency. That's made up of certain pieces of geography we call states. And they're in different regions of the country, and they have different different populations, different demographic trends that drive them to vote as they do. You've got to put together a puzzle, John, that basically speaks to winning enough states where you get the electoral college votes to win the election. That means you've got to build bridges to constituencies and to demographic groups. When you're in a position where you've lost demographic groups, key demographic groups, and you continue now to say things that just drives home the angst and the criticism they've had about your party, I don't know how you can hope then to recoup unless you've got a very special person out there on the stump who's able to put all the pieces back together again in the general election, which is a tough thing to do. But you've got to build bridges to those lost demographics in order to win an election from a Republican Party standpoint. And to my mind, we're going in the opposite direction.
Are you saying the GOP is in danger of becoming the GOWP, the GOWP, the Grand Old White Party?
Well, you know, parties have gone into the trash bin of history. We remember that well from 1856, I guess it was.
The Whigs.
Yeah, the Whigs, and John Fremont ran as the first Republican that year in 56. He lost, but Lincoln then won in 60. Parties are not built to last forever. They have to be responsive to the needs of the people. They have to put forward compelling, hopeful, optimistic visions for our future as a people. We're all Americans at the end of the day, and parties should speak to how you move and motivate the population. And if you don't do that, you're ultimately going to atrophy and lose appeal. And that's one of my concerns about where we sit today with the Republican Party is we're not building enough bridges. We're holding on to the old demographic, which is aging very, very quickly. But that's not an election. That's not a demographic that will allow you to win a broad-based national electoral vote.
Finally, then, on the question of immigration, an issue where there are so many details and issues related to security, related to, immigration bureaucracy, visas, special visas, H-1Bs, that people just sort of, get dizzy and tune out. Has Trump found some magic elixir by basically saying, all right, let's send all 11 million illegal immigrants back to Mexico and sort of start from zero, that on some level, intuitively, forget the impracticality of it, intuitively, he's basically saying, let's start over again and pretend they never came here, send them back, and then we'll work it on a one-by-one, case-by-case basis. And that connects with people.
Of course it does. Because when things are issues are complex and confusing and don't lend themselves to easy sound bites, you can come up with sound bites and people can say, I knew there was an easy answer out there. That's exactly what I've been thinking about this issue for a long time. Just send them all back and build a wall. And that's called pandering. You know, you can come up with sound bites when you're on the stump and people will stand up and cheer, but they're completely divorced from the reality of the issue, which in this case would be economically, logistically, I think morally unfeasible. And most people in this good country of ours would not for a second stand beside that as an option. We can fix immigration reform. All of the answers and solutions are right before us. We just don't have the political courage or the ability to cross party lines at this point to actually fashion a solution that would be good for this country. And it's sad that it's an open wound this many years after a point in time where it should have been fixed.
Because I can't resist, let me ask you before we go, as long as Trump stays in the race long term, the longer he stays in the race, who's hurt more, the Republican Party or Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think the longer he stays in the race, I think Hillary Clinton has her own problems, and she may not remain standing as the nominee at the end of the day. But I think the longer he stays in the race, I think it does hurt the big tent Republican Party. It probably closes the drawbridge on those lost demographics that we talked about earlier that need to be brought back into the big tent Reagan party in order for us to win a national election.
John Huntsman, former governor of Utah, former ambassador to China under President Obama, currently chairman of the Atlantic Council. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And hey there, thanks for listening to this edition of the Takeaway Weekender. We'll see you on Monday live from Denver, Colorado. Until then, keep up to date with everything at thetakeaway.org. And if you want, you can get an early jump on all our conversations, be a part of our listener response network. You sign up for our texts, you'll get one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program, so your voice and ideas become part of the on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply, and you can reply STOP to opt out. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is the Takeaway Weekender.
This has been the Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.